Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. The study of epigenetics and biology went from a phenomenon to a field, and it is getting a lot of attention these days. It may underlie human disease and explain why humans are so different from mice, fish, and primates, even though we share the same number of genes. What makes us so different from other animals is a mystery scientists are trying to solve. Epigenome, as it sounds, literally means above the genome. It is something that affects a cell, organ, or individual without altering the genetic code, but it could influence how DNA functions and whether a gene is turned on or off. Epigenetics is providing compelling evidence that what we eat, drink, smoke, and experience in life sculpts heritable traits that can be passed on from one generation to the next through our epigenome. In our ongoing series of programs about epigenetics, we have profiled the work of scientists at the front lines. In part one, we featured Randy Drittle, well known in the field for his research with agouti mice, that has revealed a mother's diet during pregnancy can influence gene expression in her offspring by altering the epigenome. Drittle has taken on the role of spokesperson for the field here in the U.S.
So I think of the field of epigenetics and genomics like a computer. So if you think of the genomics, DNA, being similar to the hardware of the computer, then epigenetics or epigenomics are the programs that tell that computer when, where, and how to work. So within our cell, we actually have a programmable computer. And that's why you can have a single set of genes, single genome, one from mom, one from dad, and you can have 250 to 300 different cell types because the programs are different for every one of those cells.
Last week, we heard from Moshe Sheff, a pioneer in linking epigenetic changes to the development of diseases. He championed the idea that epigenetic changes can shift through life and that those changes are important in the establishment and spread of cancer.
Cancer is an epigenetic disease and could be treated by epigenetic drugs. And I would say that perhaps a large fraction of human disease is epigenetic.
Today we hear from Wolf Reich, a world-leading authority in the field of epigenetics.
I'm professor of epigenetics at the University of Cambridge in the UK, and I work at an institute in Cambridge called the Babram Institute.
On top of the DNA code lies another genetic language, the epigenetic code. Wolf Reich has built a career of decoding this language. I talked to him at the 2011 Keystone Symposia on Epigenetics in Asheville, North Carolina.
So this very exciting area of work, the possibility that the environment and what we eat, what we experience during our lives, what we experience perhaps even as embryos, as we grow up, etc., what our parents have experienced, what our grandparents have experienced even perhaps, that has an influence on the epigenome, on the epigenetic makeup of the genome, and that can therefore affect us today in the way we are, whether we're healthy, whether we're not healthy at times, etc.
According to Reich, epigenetics is crucial to understanding disease, to making better medical diagnoses, and for finding better therapies.
The other thing that I find fascinating, and I find many people are fascinated by it, is to understand better inheritance. So what is it that we really get from our parents, from our grandparents? You know, we all know about genes, so we can tell that our eye color and things like that, our height, many of these things that, you know, the parents that look similar, so there's clearly genes there. But there are also other things now, epigenetics. And it's quite fascinating, I think, to think about that and how that can explain things where maybe the genes don't play out, you know, exactly like the cards were shuffled. And sometimes things are slightly different from how the genes dictated. And that's a fascinating area. And it's kind of almost also a liberating thought for people. that, you know, you're not necessarily a slave of your genes. So where 10 years ago, the human genome, this really important effort to sequence all the genes in the genome, was kind of heading in the direction that once we know all the genes, then we know everything, okay? So then we can explain all the diseases, we can cure all the diseases, we can explain everything that we got from our parents. And that's probably not the case. We probably have to say that's probably not the case. And so it's kind of a liberating thought also that we're not necessarily complete slaves of our genes. You know, we have some kind of other type of freedom, freedom of the genome, almost. And that also, I think, fascinates people, and, you know, it's important for people to know that, actually.
Reich was destined to become a scientist, but epigenetics was somewhat of an accident.
Both of my parents are scientists, physicists, and mathematicians, so I didn't really know that I wanted to do science, but I think it was kind of almost inevitable that I went into science. And actually, I studied medicine to begin with, and finished and qualified as a doctor, and was only towards the end of my medical work at university that I kind of felt, well, let's try and do this PhD kind of thing. Let's just try it, see how it works. I didn't know what I wanted really to do. And it was by accident almost that I bumped into one of the pioneers of epigenetics at the time, Rudolf Janisch, who's at Whitehead Institute, MIT. And I kind of just sat there in my chair and was completely taken by what he was talking about, the excitement. I could see the future excitement. And so next day I went to his lab and knocked on his door and said, can I do a PhD here? To which he responded, we're not really interested in having medics here. Which he was very qualified to say, because he's a medic himself. So that was my start of PhD work. And I was fortunate that at that time DNA methylation had just kind of appeared on the horizon. Nobody was talking about epigenetics. It wasn't called epigenetics then, but DNA methylation was around.
And what year was this?
So this was around 1985. And then I finished, and what kind of intrigued me about the work that we were doing was to try and understand more about how these epigenetic mechanisms might be involved in development. So development of an embryo from the beginning, the zygote, to an embryo, a fetus, an adult organism. This really fascinated me. And perhaps with this possible kind of idea that epigenetic mechanisms might play a role in this process. And so at that time, England was... Sorry, I forgot to say that all of this happened in Germany, okay. Where I come from. Okay. So I did all of my schooling and university in Germany.
Under one of the pioneers of epigenetics,
yeah,
there?
Yeah, he was in Hamburg at that time, and moved to MIT later.
How did you convince him to accept you as a medic?
Good question. I don't know. I just didn't leave, I guess. I just said no, but I really do want to do this. So I guess, yeah, it was a dialogue, and from that quickly developed some ideas and interests and things like that. And so I think that set me off on a path not only to be a scientist, because I never went back to practicing medicine after that, not only as a scientist, but also the direction of science and the excitement of doing kind of cutting-edge science. It just got me hooked, I think, at that time.
Reich then got excited about the possibility
that epigenetics played a role in embryo development and naturally landed in England on the front lines of embryology. Only this time, his lab was a blank canvas.
England was, at that time, very kind of leading in embryology and looking at embryos and development. Very famous people there, Ann McLaren and Richard Gardner and people like that. So England was potentially the best place for me to kind of pick up on this and study it. And so I went there and visited, and I bumped into another pioneer of epigenetics, which is Azim Surani, who discovered imprinting. And again, I started talking to him, and I got really hooked with what he was doing, how he was approaching science, how he was thinking. He's a very deep and careful kind of thinker. And again, this was an interesting kind of situation, because the labs that they had at the time, there was absolutely no molecular biology there. There was just animal work. And it was a little bit like a farm, because there was also other types of animal work. There were pigs and sheep, and it was a little bit out in the sticks and a farm, and no molecular biology. And Azim, when I kind of arrived or decided to go there, talked with him, he showed me an empty room in the building and said, "This is our molecular biology lab." So I'm still...
Was there a microscope?
There was very little in that room, actually. So I'm still surprised that, having come from a kind of cutting-edge molecular biology kind of environment, that the lab in Hamburg was that I decided to go there. But it was the excitement of this business of imprinting and the kind of idea that there were things that were passed on from parents to children, which were not based on DNA, which were outside of the information that's in the DNA and the sequence. And this fascinated me, this idea that, you know, there could be inheritance. That could be things that we parents give to their children, which is not based on DNA sequence. And I think this is one of the, you know, most important principles in epigenetics that there is. And this got me so excited that I decided to move into that empty room and set it up and equip it as you would a modern molecular biology laboratory and start work there in Cambridge.
And then how long did that take to set up that laboratory?
So I probably took a few months to set things up, because I was kind of a spoiled PhD student who had everything in the previous lab, and, you know, everything was there and set up for me to use. And now I had to kind of think again and try, how did this actually work? How do you actually set this up? How do you set this piece of equipment up? So... It was a challenging time, as well as a pioneering time, in a sense.
And were there people telling you, you know, you won't have a career if you do this?
I can't remember. It's a good question. I think if they did, I probably didn't want to hear it. Didn't want to listen to it, and so that's why I don't remember that happening. No, it quickly picked up. And we were in this fortunate position that imprinting had just been discovered, the phenomenon, but there was no molecular mechanism at all. And it kind of fell to me and other people in the lab to kind of find a molecular approach to the problem and find a way that we could maybe discover what was sitting on top of the DNA, what was attached to the DNA, what was, you know, something to do with the genome, but not DNA sequence, that was behind this kind of phenomenon.
Genomic imprinting is the process during development that sometimes leads to the exclusive expression of specific genes from only one parent.
I want to go back just a little bit and ask your lab how it's changed from that time when there was nothing in it, and to what does it look like now, and how many students and postdocs and colleagues? Yeah.
So, well, now, fortunately, it's different. It's not an empty room. It's full of wonderful people. So in my lab, there is about 14, 15 people. Most of them are postdocs. Some of them are students. And then we're very fortunate that we have quite a big division at the Babram Institute in Cambridge, which is epigenetics. And so there's probably about 65, 70 people all working on epigenetics. It's one of the biggest centers in the world on epigenetics research. And it's, you know, we have everything that we need. We have big sequencing machines, which is the most important thing right now for this business. And we have all the facilities, all the modern molecular biology facilities that we need. And we're building a new building next year. Which will be exciting, actually.
Reich and his team use mice as their main model organism for research.
Maybe because I have this background as a doctor, medical doctor, then we're always trying to apply our findings to disease situations. So I have worked with colleagues quite a lot on applying findings from models that we've made in mice to patient situations. There was a talk today about the Beckwith-Wiedemann syndrome, which is a syndrome where babies grow very large, they develop certain cancers, and we did a lot of work based on the work that we did in mice originally to kind of look at the epigenetics of that disease. At the moment, we're not so directly engaged with this. But what we've done over the years is to find correlations between the epigenetic makeup of particular gene regions and the symptoms that these children develop. So, for example, there is a particular epigenetic marker that can tell you whether the child is more or less likely to develop cancer. And this is very useful for a physician to have that kind of marker and that information to be then monitoring the child much more carefully than they would otherwise. Okay. So it's a useful thing. But that's a little bit in the past. Our current work is more involved with this business of epigenetic reprogramming.
Reich's laboratory is interested in epigenetic gene programming and reprogramming in mammalian development.
So the key kind of interest that we have currently is to understand something that's going on in early embryos as well as in germ cells that give rise to egg and sperm. And that's a process whereby epigenetic information is actually erased from the genome. So it's taken off.
A lot of researchers are working on how epigenetic marks are established in development and how that may depend on the environment, diet, and behavior.
So what we do is we study a process by which the epigenetic information is taken off the DNA. And this happens particularly in germ cells and early embryos. And the idea behind this is that you take off epigenetic information which was there previously from the parents, etc., previous generations, in order to allow the embryo to start development again. So it's basically like, you can imagine it's like wiping out information so that all of the cells, when the zygote starts to develop into an embryo, so that all of the cells can then develop in different directions and different tissues and different body parts, etc. And for that to happen, we think is that you need to erase, take off this memory which was there from what happened previously. So for a life to start, from scratch anew, you need to take the memory away, basically, is the idea.
Reich says they do this in the lab. But it is basically a natural process. It happens in every embryo, immediately after fertilization and germ cells, in normal development.
This is key or very important for normal development to occur. So what we do, we study this process in the lab and try and understand how it works, what molecules are involved, etc., etc. What it does, if it goes wrong, what goes wrong. You know, do we use the insights that we get from that in the lab to apply it? And we do. And this is also interesting because, again, at this meeting, we heard a lot about how you can reprogram adult cells into embryo cells. And so it's this process of so-called iPS cell generation. It's also possible to do this by cloning, where you take an adult cell and put it into a zygote, into an oocyte, and get development again. And for this process of reprogramming, which in the end can be very useful for therapy, you know, getting cells for patients, for this kind of process, this reprogramming is very, very important. So it's, if you imagine that you take an adult cell, what has to happen is that you make it forget that it was an adult cell. And so you try and do that by wiping out the epigenome or by erasing the epigenome. And if we can find ways by which the epigenome is reprogrammed in this way, in the natural situation in embryos, then we can apply those kind of insights to making this kind of process, getting stem cells from adult cells for patient, more effective, more efficient, and safer in the end to use in patients as well. Yeah.
Fascinating that you could wipe out the memory of a cell, then reprogram it, yeah. Right? And is it possible to describe that process?
I think I'll spare you the molecular details of it, but I mean, it's all got to do with what we call epigenetic marks. So these are things that are little chemical groups that are attached to DNA. And normally, as you know, the DNA just reads as a code, you know, G, A, T, C, all the four bases repeated again and again. But in epigenetics, there is additional information attached to the DNA. So it could be chemical groups called methyl groups attached to DNA. The DNA itself, which is 2 meters long in each of our cells, is wrapped up with proteins, which are called histones, so that eventually all of this stuff fits into a tiny little cell. So all of these things together that stick to the DNA, methyl groups, histones, etc., form this epigenetic layer of information. And so what we're trying to do is to find processes and enzymes and things that change this and erase it. And so what we're trying to find is chemical processes, biochemical processes that can take methyl group out of the DNA. So other people are working on how you can put them in the DNA, again, in response to environment, to diet, and all of these kind of things. And we address the opposite question is, well, can we identify things that take it off the DNA and erase that memory that the cell has? And so we are making a little bit of progress with that. And so we've identified two pathways by which methyl groups can be taken off the DNA. And in essence, this involves another chemical way that they're modified by, and which then enables the basic kind of chemistry in the cell to attack this methyl group. So normally a methyl group on its own is a very stable thing. Once it's attached to DNA, it hangs on for sheer life. It's very, very stable. It's almost like, you could imagine it almost like a fifth letter in the DNA code. it's so stable, really stuck to the DNA. And so something has to happen to it first, chemically, that makes it less stable and makes it kind of easier to snip off, basically, the DNA. And that's the kind of things that we work on, and we've identified a number of pathways that can do that.
In fact, two papers on Reich's findings were published in the scientific journal Nature in March and April 2011.
And this shows how a pathway called hydroxymethylation, which is basically the way that we can chemically weaken the methyl group to make it, you know, easy to snip off the DNA, is involved in that process of removing these marks and making the cells more stem cell-like, more embryo-like, more better to use in therapeutic approaches. That story is focused on stem cells, so-called ES cells, embryonic stem cells. And what it kind of describes is how the removal process of epigenetic information, the only explanation, and that epigenetic changes, some mediated by the environment, some mediated by smoking, etc., can very well contribute to that.
And now it is possible to take a cell from any organ in the adult body.
We also do that, but the key thing that we're doing is what we were kind of talking about a little bit, which is to erase epigenetic marks. I mean, it's all got to do with what we call epigenetic marks. So these are things that are little chemical groups that are attached to DNA. And normally, as you know, the DNA just reads as a code, you know, G, A, T, C, all the four bases repeated again and again. But in epigenetics, there is additional information attached to the DNA. So it could be chemical groups called methyl groups attached to DNA. The DNA itself, which is 2 meters long in each of our cells, is wrapped up with proteins, which are called histones, so that eventually all of the stuff fits into a tiny little cell. So all of these things together that stick to the DNA, methyl groups, histones, etc., form this epigenetic layer of information that everybody at the meeting is talking about and is excited about. And so what we're trying to do is to find processes and enzymes and things that change this and erase it. And so what we're trying to find is chemical processes, biochemical processes that can take methyl group out of the DNA. So other people at the meeting are working on how you can put them in the DNA, again, in response to environment, to diet, and all of this kind of things. And we address the opposite question is, well, can we identify things that take it off the DNA and as you said, erase that memory that the cell has? And so we are making a little bit of progress with that. And so we've identified two pathways by which methyl groups can be taken off the DNA. And in essence, this involves another chemical way that they're modified by, and which then enables the basic kind of chemistry in the cell to attack this methyl group. So normally a methyl group on its own is a very stable thing. Once it's attached to DNA, it hangs on for sheer life. It's very, very stable. It's almost like, you could imagine it almost like a fifth letter in the DNA code. It's so stable, really stuck to the DNA. And so something has to happen to it first, chemically, that makes it less stable and makes it kind of easier to snip off, basically, the DNA. And that's the kind of things that we work on, and we've identified a number of pathways that can do that.
And is that what you're publishing then one of those pathways?
So one paper's just come out in Nature Communications a couple of weeks ago, and the second one is coming out in Nature this Sunday, 3rd of April. And this shows how a pathway called hydroxymethylation, which is basically the way that we can chemically weaken the methyl group to make it, you know, easy to snip off the DNA, is involved in that process of removing these marks and making the cells more stem cell-like, more embryo-like, more, you know, eventually more better to use in therapeutic approaches.
And then how long did this take?
How long did this work take? Yeah. The last work, actually, the paper that we're publishing on Sunday, from start to finish wasn't so long, but we knew that we were racing the competition. So this is a kind of a very exciting area at the moment, and there are several groups internationally working on this. So I think we started this work about 2 years ago, which in our kind of science is not that long, actually. Often pieces of work that we do in the lab can take 4 or 5 years or something like that to come to a conclusion and publication. So 2 years is pretty quick, actually.
Yeah, yeah. That does sound quick, actually, yeah. for something like this.
And there are several groups that are publishing probably concurrently with us, or maybe a little bit later. Several, as I was telling you, it's a little bit of a race.
Mm-hmm.
And several papers will be coming out on this new mechanism, so this is exciting time. Yeah.
What other labs are there that you're racing with, so to speak?
So there's a lab in Copenhagen. There's a lab in the U.S. Can't remember now where it which university comes back in the moment, which university it is. So it's basically some of the big European, Japanese, and U.S. Big epigenetics labs that kind of are trying to chase this down at the moment.
Okay. Just had a couple more questions for you. Just want to make sure that, and by the way, thank you for explaining it so well. And so you're probably having to explain things that are very
tricky. They're technical, you know. I mean, you listen to the talks, right?
Yeah, and I honestly, I don't get that much because I don't have the background. Yeah. I get little pieces.
So it can get technical very quickly.
Yeah. So I appreciate you explaining it all from the beginning, and so it's really easy, I think, but it comes across well for the listeners and for me to understand.
I have a little bit of media experience.
Oh, okay.
I work with the Science Media Centre in London, actually, is an outfit that is set up to engage scientists and the public. And, you know, they teach you how to do things.
Oh, they did.
Which is great. Very useful. Very useful.
Worked out really well.
Yeah.
Okay, I just wanted to find a couple other things that Randy brought up to mention. Is your work then establishing, or is it how the epigenome is established? Is that what you're working
on? Yeah, I mean, we also do that. But the key thing that we're doing is what we were kind of talking about a little bit, which is to erase epigenetic marks. Now, that is kind of also important to then establish new ones, because if you haven't erased them properly, you sometimes can't establish them, you know, the new ones properly. And so taking things off is probably also quite important, so that we don't necessarily inherit bad habits from our parents sometimes, because it's possible that their epigenome, you know, experienced things through nutritional things. We heard about famine, for example, or smoking, or, you know, all sorts of things. And it may be a good idea to kind of largely take those influences off as we develop, because otherwise we might kind of inherit the sins of our parents in the epigenome, if you wish. I mean, there are examples of where environmental influences, smoking, etc., seems to have these kind of influences from grandparents to parents to children also. And that's another important theme at the meeting, is so-called transgenerational epigenetic inheritance. And how, you know, how often does that occur in humans? How important is it? Does it affect us? Does it, you know, affect how susceptible we are to certain diseases, etc., etc.? And this is very important to establish, and very exciting to establish, I think. And one of the things that's kind of a little bit clear from our work, I think, is that that a lot of that information, that epigenetic stuff that grandparents, parents, etc., contributed, probably gets erased again, probably gets, you know, taken off the epigenome again by this mechanism that we were talking about, the epigenetic reprogramming mechanism. So that, unlike in plants, where this kind of thing is very common, because plants don't appear to have a very effective wiping out kind of system mechanism. In humans, it's probably the case that this type of epigenetic inheritance is not as frequent. I mean, certainly nothing compared with the genetic inheritance, with the influence of the genes, which is the dominant heritable influence that we have.
So not only are they figuring out how the epigenome is established and how to make markers, they are figuring out how to erase epigenetic marks, which raises the possibility of erasing disease and bad habits. There are two phases involved in wiping out these marks.
One is in the germ cells themselves. So these are the cells that lead to sperm and egg, that are kind of the precursor cells, if you wish, of the actual sperm and egg. And then there's another wiping out phase, which is just after fertilization in very early embryos. And that one in very early embryos probably has to do with the fact that these cells kind of need to forget very quickly that there were egg and sperm, because egg and sperm are quite special cells and specialized cells, whereas early embryos are obviously very kind of multitasking type of cells. They can do lots of different things. And this is why we think the wiping out mechanism has to be there right at the beginning of life, immediately after fertilization, to make this kind of thing possible. You know, you can kind of think of it like the brain. You know, you want, when you grow up as a child, you don't want your brain clogged up with all of the memories that, say, your parents acquired, right? Mm-hmm. So, because that's important so that you can learn, that you can survive in an environment, etc. And so it's like a little bit like the brain. You want to not carry around excess information that you got earlier. So it's a little bit like that. Early embryos also don't want excess information, because they can then, you know, develop in all directions and do new things, basically. That's the idea.
Reich and his colleagues have observed transgeneration effects from behaviors such as smoking in human populations. If your grandparents smoked, they suspect it can show up in your own epigenome.
At the moment, we don't know how they work. But from mouse models and other types of model organisms, you can ask how this kind of thing can happen, obviously. And not all the information gets wiped out. So apparently some of the epigenetic marks do stick. and can be heritable from grandparents to parents to children. Not all of them, as we said, because a lot of it gets wiped out. But some of it can apparently survive. And this may be behind these kind of transgenerational effects that people observe to do with smoking, things like that. But there are also increasingly some very good animal models where influence of particular substitutes in the diet get investigated and see what effect that might have on the epigenome and potentially on transgenerational heritable kind of situation, actually.
Some parents might not be too happy about it, right? Because not only can you blame your hair and eye color on them, but maybe a few other traits.
Well, you know? So I tell you, I was talking to a German journalist a few months back. He was telling me that people in Germany, maybe also in other places, are beginning to think about suing their parents and their grandparents for the potential damage that they could have done to their epigenome. Just think about the, you know, in the future also the potential ethical implications that epigenetics might have in the future. So it's all happening. Apparently there's a website where people are beginning to kind of talk about these ideas and thinking about it and getting legal advice, all this kind of stuff. Watch this space.
Professor Wolf Reich discovered epigenetic reprogramming, and he found the environment influences epigenetic programming in embryos, with changes in gene expression persisting in adults and their offspring. He is a fellow of the Royal Society, a self-governing fellowship of many of the world's most distinguished scientists. Thank you for listening. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn, Susie Montgomery, and Elaine Taylor.